How many times have you heard the same answers when it comes to things like market analysis and market selection? We look for jobs, we look for diversification of employment, and we look for population growth. Yeah, but so does everyone else. And what does that actually mean? Looking for jobs, for example, isn't really something I can go home and replicate for my own business, and therefore that suggestion isn't really that useful to me. Now, as you know, the way that this program is a little differentiated from some of the other podcasts that are out there is that we really like to get into the details and provide the type of content that really makes you stop, think, maybe even listen to the same episode twice, but most importantly, provides you with the tools to become a better investor. Now, I have heard our guest for today speak several times, but the first time I saw him speak, I thought, him and I are going to create some awesome content together. Why? Because he knows what he's talking about, and he's not afraid to give away the playbook, which is something I really respect and am very sympathetic to. So for today, we're actually going to talk about market selection in detail. So when people say, we want population growth, what does that really mean mathematically? How can you actually track that in an objective way so that you can run it through that algorithm and give it a pass-fail? When people track median income, for example, what metrics are they actually looking at in terms of things like respective housing costs? Because wouldn't that be an important metric to track? We're also going to talk about employment. And this is something that comes up in a lot of these conversations, but how do you validate some of the claims that may be on Forbes.com saying that your city is one of the top 10 in terms of employment? What does that actually mean? Where is the data actually coming from? And how can you make this an objective metric that you can actually use? All of this is going to be covered in detail. And I promise, if you listen to this whole episode and don't learn something that you can actually start implementing immediately, I'll eat my hat. As you can probably tell from the interview, I find our guest's investment thesis very compelling. And if you do too, you may be interested in our current offering, which is a workforce housing fund. We partnered with an incredibly well-positioned operating partner with a remarkable track record, the types of operating partners we really want to grow our business together with. And we provide our investors with a really unique investment vehicle that I think is really favorable for a lot of reasons. So if you're interested in investing with us and you haven't yet created an account with ASYM Capital, go over there, asymcapital.com, click invest, sign up for an account, and you'll have instant access to our workforce housing fund, which we're really excited about. The response has already been very, very positive, and we want to continue that momentum. All right, hope you enjoy the episode. How's it going, everyone? Our guest for today is Neil Bawa, affectionately known by his friends as the mad scientist of multifamily. He's a technologist and an entrepreneur who is in love with the power of numbers and the way they create profit for his real estate investors. He's the CEO and founder of Grow Capitus, which is a commercial real estate investment company where Neil acquires commercial properties across the U.S. for more than 300 investors. His current portfolio has more than 1,800 units of multifamily and student housing and is projected to be at closer to 3,000 units in the next 12 months. He also serves as the CEO at Multifamily U, which is an apartment investing education company. Massive, massive amount of content on there. Many, many webinars. He's a great speaker. He's spoken at many conferences all across the country. And nearly 4,000 students have attended his multifamily seminars each year. And hundreds attend his Magic of Multifamily boot camps. Well, Neil, it sounds like you and I have at least two things in common, maybe more, depending on how this interview goes. But both of us are truly in love with real estate, and also it sounds like we both really love to help educate people. And that's something I really like. And it's one of the reasons I was really happy to have you on. So thanks again for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Hunter. Absolutely. My true passion isn't even real estate. It is simply education. You know, my mother was a teacher. My sister's a teacher, sister-in-law, father-in-law, mother-in-law are all teachers. So I come from a family of teachers, and I came to the United States as a network engineering instructor. And that was in 1997. And so education is actually less important than aha moments that stick in people's minds. So my goal is not to educate people. My goal is to give them nuggets that they cannot get out of their head because the information was transferred in such a way that that nugget is now stuck there for the next 30 years.
Absolutely. It's like Inception, right? It's the strongest way to make that connection with memory.
I love it. I'm going to steal that. I'm going to use that Inception, piece again. I should have already figured that one out.
No, that's perfect. So look, we're going to talk about education. We're going to talk about multifamily. We're going to talk about the economy. Before we do, though, let's talk about how you really got started in this sector. You know, you mentioned came here as a educational engineer. Let's talk about that and then how you segued into investing in real estate.
Yeah, it's interesting how I got started, right? Most people get started in real estate with like a single family rental, right? So that's the most common, or a fixer flip. Those are two super common ways. I got started in reverse, Hunter. So for my day job in 2003, I was tasked along with my CEO on building a campus from scratch for our company. So it was a technology education and healthcare education company based here in Silicon Valley. And we were growing really fast. Our revenue was going up. And so we had the money to actually buy a building and build it from scratch. So it was just a shell building. It had four walls. It was 27,000 square feet. The ceiling was 22 feet high. And so we basically had to convert it into a mixed-use campus, which had offices, it had classrooms, it had storage space. There was a lot of different uses. And I was basically thrown in because my CEO decided that we were not going to renew our lease. But by the time we got into contract on this space, we only had 9 months left. And our landlord, General Motors, they had a building here in Fremont, said that if you go over on your lease, we will charge you $10,000 a day. So imagine the pressure of taking a complete shell building and building it from scratch, getting it approved, going through all of the processes, the approvals. I learned so much, everything from egress to fire codes to room loads to air conditioning to heating requirements. There was so much to learn. And all of a sudden, I went from knowing nothing about real estate to actually knowing a heck of a lot about, you know, real estate construction. And then 2 years later, we filled out that campus and I had to repeat the process. The only difference being this time, the campus behind us, the building behind us, was bigger and more expensive. And as a result, we didn't have enough money to just buy it outright and do the work. So this time, we invited a bunch of doctors here in Fremont, California. And we basically went to them and said, everyone, buy from us a 2,000 square foot suite. We will build the suite for you and then we'll rent it back from you. And Hunter, I thought, you know, maybe one out of those 10 people that we were talking to would say yes. 10 out of 10 said yes. And it took me 4 years to figure out why. They were all laughing at me because I was supposed to charge them 5% of the project as fee, because typically when you do new construction as a syndicator, you charge 5% of the project size. In this case, the project size was $7 million. So I should have charged them a $350,000 fee. But I didn't know that I was supposed to charge the fee. I didn't know that what I'd just done was called a syndication. I didn't discover that for another 3 or 4 years. But it's not a bad story, because everyone won in that story. My students won. They got a nicer, bigger campus. My company had space to grow. I personally had a suite. And then all these doctors, for the last 12 years, have had their suites rented out by my business, right? So it was a happy ending story that was a win-win-win-win and really catapulted me into real estate. And from then onwards, I went the standard path, you know, the single family, the triplexes, and then the big syndications, passive first and then active.
Interesting. Okay. So that's a really interesting story there. So what is it that made you go the route specifically focused on housing as opposed to some of the other asset classes? Was it just because that's what you knew? And then what is it that made you transition solely out of that duplex, triplex into the larger multifamily syndications?
So as a senior I was the senior most executive in the company. The first thing that I learned was the biggest job of a senior executive is to keep an eye on scale, right? We went from 10 employees to 400 on the day that we sold the company in 2013. And the only way to get from 10 to 400 is to reinvent your company basically every 3 to 4 years. You have to restructure it, reinvent it. And so you're focused on scale. And when I noticed very quickly that multifamily had vastly better scale than single family. You know, I bought 10 single families in 2009 and 2010. I bought 10 triplexes in Chicago in 2011, 2012, and 13. And I noticed that the triplexes scaled better than the single families. But my passive investments into multifamily syndication, I put more than $1 million into passive syndications in multifamily, scaled massively better. You know, obviously as a passive, you don't spend much time, but I was reading all of the reports that were coming in from my active syndicators, and I could see that the scale was incredible. I looked at it and said, for somebody that respects the value of his time, this is vastly more efficient than single family, right? Not just more efficient, it's 10x or 100x more efficient. And I loved that efficiency. Having said that, Hunter, I did invest in other asset classes. So as a passive, I'm invested in office, I'm invested in retail, I'm invested in hotels. But when I looked at all of those, I still came back to this. Fundamentally, if you look at a 10 to 20 year timeline, because multifamily is a need, and both offices and hotels and also retail is a want, the overall 20-year performance was not just better, but also more stable for multifamily. I am very conservative in nature, so I am going to naturally gravitate to the thing that has the better long-term stability, not the better cash flow. Hotels actually cash flow better than multifamily.
Right, just incredibly cyclical, right? Because yes, the first thing that goes is all those trips, whether it's corporate or non-corporate, non-commercial, vacations and such. It's the first thing to go. So the predictability of outcome is significantly decreased, even though the cash flow can be good year one, terrible year two. I mean, that's not really the way that we want to build our portfolio for sure.
Exactly. I mean, what I wanted was a higher level of stability. And so it's very hard to get that with hotels. To be honest, I mean, they're extremely cyclical in nature. And at this point, retail, I'm scared beyond belief for retail because we've had 3 to 4 years of subpar growth in retail, you know, malls and strip malls and those sorts of things. While we've gone from 3% to 6% of all transactions in the US being online, that's just 3 to 6. We are projecting that over the next 10 years, we will go from 6% to 25%. The bloodbath that will ensue at that point is going to be spectacular. And as a multifamily syndicator, I am, you know, candidly looking forward to that because what will end up happening is so many strip malls will go out of business and so many malls will become insolvent that they will need solutions. And multifamily syndicators like me will come in and do mixed use. I'm already reaching out to malls in high quality places and saying, hey, let's see if we can convince the city to do a mixed use where I'm going to build a parking lot. You know, your mall has huge amounts of parking, so we may not need parking, but let's build a parking lot if necessary. And I'm going to build a 7-story multifamily building above your mall, right? And then rebrand the mall. So I'll build the retail. You go and rebrand the mall to a higher level and let's make it work together. So there's got to be solutions to this, but there's no doubt that retail is going to face a bloodbath. From 3 to 6, we've seen so many problems. Imagine what happens when we go from 6% to 25% of all transactions.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly find out because I don't think there's any arguing that that number is going to continue to increase. Mm-hmm. So within the multifamily sector, what's your typical bread and butter purchase? If there is a typical bread and butter purchase right now, given where we are in the cycle.
There is. And actually, we've got an acronym for it. So my bread and butter, which by itself is a term, is called lipstick on a pig, right? So we do 3 to 4 projects a year that are called lipstick on a pig. And we basically buy 60s, mostly 70s products, some 80s products, a mixture of 70s and 80s product. And these are buildings that really need a lot of attention. They need a lot of work, but they don't need structural work. What they don't need is breaking through walls. What they don't need is, you know, fixing foundations. What they don't need is replace 100% of the roofs. What they need is a lot of cosmetic work. And so what we do is some of these projects, we put lipstick on them. Some of them lean more. So it's lipstick and mascara and eyeshadow and, you know, those sorts of things to really get them to the point where we're able to boost rents by $150 to $200. In this, we are no different from anybody else in the U.S. Our secret sauce is not the product that we are buying because everybody else is buying the same product and doing the same things with it. Our secret sauce is data, both before the purchase and after the purchase. So we use data very uniquely, both before buying and after buying. And both of those things give us a class-leading advantage in our industry. And we are recognized as people that do these two things different from anyone else in the US.
One of the things that I was really excited to talk to you about is I know that you take economics, market analysis really seriously. What is your approach to market analysis? Because I understand that this is, you know, research in terms of demographics, income, things like that, something that you really focus on. Let's walk us through some of those processes in terms of identifying things that are important to pay attention to in a market. And then let's talk about some of the markets that you think are prime examples of, you know, textbook great market for multifamily investment.
Sure. Just so you know, most textbook multifamily markets are also textbook single-family markets. There's very few exceptions to that. So to me, it really is all about the demographics. And everything I'm about to say is not going to be new to your listeners. What is going to be new are the ranges, the nuances, the specifics of those metrics. So we tend to first look at five metrics. And by the way, I see a lot of people talking about this stuff. I also hear them on podcasts, but then I see where they're buying. And those things do not match. So they couldn't possibly be actually using the demographics. They're simply talking about them.
Yes, so, this is exactly why I wanted to have you on. Right. Just saying demographics is not an answer to that question, right? It's like, okay, what does that mean, right? And this is, right. let's do it.
Exactly. So to me, here's what people say, and here's what they should do, all right? So first, let's talk about what they say. So we go in places where there's population increase. That's correct. You should always invest in places where there's significant increases in population. But increasing population is not the basis on which you should make investments. A certain percentage of population increase. So for most markets in the US, 80% of investable markets in the US, that population growth number is roughly 1.5% a year. You're looking at 1.5% population growth, or as close to that as possible. I also cut corners on this because sometimes the other four metrics are really good, but I'm never investing into a marketplace that is at zero population growth. And I consistently see people investing in places. For example, Google, how many syndications you've seen in, let's say, places like Shreveport, Louisiana? You're going to see syndications in Shreveport, Louisiana, people buying stuff. Well, that's a market where population is declining. What about Dayton, Ohio? Population decline. What about Detroit, Michigan? Population decline. What about Cleveland? Population decline. So people are continuously investing into areas that have population declines. And what's even worse is they're taking tens of millions of dollars of investor money and investing into places that have population decline. Now, can they not make any money on those places, Hunter? No, that's not true. You can make money. But let me explain what they're doing, okay? A typical aircraft, when it travels through the US, travels at 550 miles an hour, right? That's the most typical speed. When you have a declining population, think of that plane as having a 200-mile headwind. That's what a population decline is. Your plane, which was going at 550, now has a 200-mile headwind. So now its average speed is 350, not 550. Now, think of a 2% annualized population growth as a 200-mile tailwind, and a 1.5% population growth as a 150-mile tailwind. So now, in an area that is like Provo, Utah, which has a 2% or higher population growth, your 550-mile-an-hour plane is now flying, zooming, screaming at 750, right? That's what these are. These are headwinds and tailwinds. They don't destroy you, but they allow you to go much faster.
Right.
So that's population. And that's the first metric I look at. The second metric that I always look at is the median household income. So that metric is more important than the population growth. Because let's say you're investing in Cleveland with slightly declining population, right? You might do well if you're investing in Cleveland in an area where the median household income is between 40,000 and 70,000, hopefully more on the 50, 60, 70 than the 40. Why? Because people there can afford to pay for housing. You might have trouble raising rents, but your project might still do well, right? But what I'm seeing and what I'm horrified by is not only are people investing in places that are losing population, such as Dayton, Ohio, they are then investing and doing syndications in areas where the median household income is lower than $40,000. Well, do the math on that. How are you going to charge? You're going into a building that's $850 in rents. You're now going to go in there and rehab it. Now you want to charge $1,000 in rents, and you want to raise that by 3% a year, which means a 15% increase over 5 years. So by the fifth year, people have to be basically paying a minimum of $1,150 minimum, right? A lot of your units are going to be above that, $1,300, $1,400. And so essentially, you're charging $15,000 a year in rent. Well, if people's incomes are $30,000, how can they afford to pay $15,000 in rent? This is just gross rent. There's other costs of living in an apartment. There's pet fees. There's all sorts of other fees that you have to pay. So now your cost of rent, not even including the bills that they're paying, their gas bill or whatever other bills they're paying, their cable, is already over 60% of income. How could there be a good outcome to a project like that? But I continuously see it. I see it all the time. People investing in areas where the average income is $30,000, $32,000, $34,000, $36,000. Here's the rule of thumb, Hunter. Once your median household income decreases below $40,000, your delinquency starts to rise. Mm-hmm. Between $40,000 and $35,000, you'll see a spike. And that spike will mean that your delinquency will be higher, your legal costs will be higher, and your churn, the speed at which people leave or are getting kicked out because they're not paying, is going to go up. But it's still manageable until 35. Once your income goes below 35,000, the average tenant that lives in that area really doesn't care about their credit. And so now your delinquency really starts to spike. And by the time you hit $30,000 in median income or lower, your delinquency is so insane that your chances of actually making any money at all are highly remote. You have to be a super stud to make any money. Basically, below $30,000, your plane has a 400 or 500 mile headwind. So it's actually not moving at all. And that's how important income is. But I don't actually see people understanding these numbers. The 40,000, the 35,000, the 30,000 are not numbers that are understood. And these numbers are not understood by people that have $200 million portfolios. And you might say, well, you got to $200 million. But Hunter, $200 million is not a sign of success. What's a sign of success is cash flow to investors. God knows how many of those people are actually, how many projects are actually cash flowing, right? So maybe he's very good with marketing, mm-hmm. right? Maybe he's good with sales. So to me, I think what we have to understand is that there's a very direct correlation between success and median household income. Once you go the other way, above $45,000, your properties start to stabilize. At 50, you're now entering a B class, right? So a lot of people talk about what is a C class and a B class. Well, they're actually tied back to income, right? So around 50, you're entering B territory. And that B territory is going to run from about $50,000 to $70,000. And then beyond that, you're now entering A territory beyond $70,000. And there's going to be no cash flow really once you go beyond $70,000 in median income. It's going to be very hard for you to really make a property cash flow. Some might, but it's rare.
Right.
And so these classes that people talk about all the time, brokers routinely say stuff like, this is a B minus area. Okay, they say stuff like that. It's so absurd. I hear this all the time. This is a B minus area. Okay, what's the median household income? Well, they'll give you a median household income, but you notice that their median household income, they're using zip code. Now, if you use a neighborhood tool like Neighborhood Scout and pull that income, you'll notice it's always lower, like $34,000. Well, how can a B minus neighborhood be $34,000 in income, right? You're in the C minus area because you dropped below $35,000. And this is what happens every day of the year with every, you know, project that I look at. Everyone's just messing these things up because they don't understand just these first two numbers. There's five metrics, but just these first two, I see that they're being used in just ways to get investors, right? They're everyone's mutating these numbers and not using them the way that they were ever meant to be used because they don't understand them. They don't spend time with them.
Right. They're just using, it's a marketing deck, basically. By the way, I'm sure my listeners are just chuckling. This is why, you guys can tell why him and I are going to get along, right? Just complaining about the things we're seeing in the marketplace right now, just by using buzzwords, essentially. Okay, cool. So we've gotten through the first two. You made some excellent points on those. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to number three.
Number three is median home price increases. So a lot of times people talk about things like population. They talk about things like income. But it's also important to look at increases, right? So what you want to see is growth. You want to see a growth in income. Now, on the income side, I want to see a growth of roughly 1.5% a year. So I want to go into a market where the income is growing 1.5% a year because our inflation rate in the US is 1.5% and has been 1.5% since 2011. And so I want that 1.5% increase so that the people living in that area can tolerate at least, they're at least tracking inflation. Now, most of the time I go into areas where incomes are increasing over 2%. Now, home prices, I want them to increase a lot faster. I want home prices in an area to increase by 2.5% a year, right? So population, 1.5. You know, on the income side, 2%. On the home price increases, 2.5. And most markets I go into, home prices are increasing at 3% or greater. Now, you might say, over the last 5 or 6 years, Neil, that's every market in the US. Yes, but that was the past. I look at the last 12 months because the market has become more sane in the last 12 months. What happened before that was one-time insanity. So it's best to avoid it and not get your numbers mixed up. But now when you look at the last 12 months home price growth, the most of the US has become insane. The San Francisco Bay Area, for example, lost, you know, prices went down. They went down by a very small amount. But the Bay Area is becoming sane. Seattle basically was flat over the last 12 months. Denver was slight increases. So now the market is becoming sane. So I'm looking at the last 12 months and saying, where can I get 2.5% annualized home price increases? And again, most of the markets I'm going to give you today, they just blow all these numbers away. They're not better. They just crush them. Right? Because there are many such markets in the US. And that is my answer to the question, are we at the end of the cycle? The answer is, we are at the end of some cycles. We are at the beginning of some and in the middle of some. There are 2,200 real estate cycles in the United States because there are 2,200 cities. So every city is in its own cycle. And I'll give you examples of cities that are at the end of the cycle and cities that are closer to the beginning of the cycle. So that's the third one, right? The third metric. And then the fourth one, I'm looking at crime reduction. I want to see crime go down. There's many ways to find, you know, crime statistics on the web. You can Google, you know, your preferred city. Let's say you're looking at Philadelphia. You can basically Google Philadelphia crime. Another easy cheat way of doing it is to Google Philadelphia space crime space city-data.com. And you'll see a table on city-data.com. And in that table, the city data crime index should be lower than 500 for a city. So firstly, it should be decreasing. It'll give you the crime for the last 10, 15 years. So you can look at all the numbers in one line. And what you want to see is that over time, crime is decreasing. And the newest number, the most recent number, which tends to be about 2 years old, should be below 500 in terms of a crime index. So cities that are way above 500 are parts of Oakland, all of South Chicago, Memphis, Tennessee, St. Louis, Missouri, very, very high crime cities, extraordinarily high crime cities. So that's why I tend not to invest in them, because high crime cities are perfectly viable when unemployment is below 5%. But when unemployment goes to 8 or 9 or 10, their crime doesn't double, it quadruples.
Mm-hmm. People don't have anything to do.
Because they're high crime in nature, yeah. Right? And when people are employed, they don't have the time to commit crimes.
Yeah.
When they're unemployed, they have an ecosystem of crime around them. And so crime goes insane in cities like Memphis when unemployment rates go over 7 or 8%.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, cool. So I'm keeping track here. Correct me if I'm wrong. So we have population increase. We have median household income. We have median income increases and home price increases.
Median home price increases. Correct. Yeah. In general, on the median household income, I'm looking at both numbers, right? Those minimum numbers that I gave you, the 40,000 and above.
Yep.
And then I'm looking at, you know, I want incomes to go up, you know, as close to 2% as possible. I know inflation's 1.5%, but if you can get to 2%, you also have a little bit of room to grow your rents, right? You're able to push them up a little bit more.
Yep.
Then otherwise you'll only be able to increase rents by 1.5%. Right? That's tracking inflation. So look for 2, which is a better number. And there's plenty of places in the US where you can get 2% or greater, you know, increases in income on an annualized basis. And then my fourth metric I gave you was crime reduction.
Yep.
The fifth one is jobs, right? So a website called departmentofnumbers.com publishes jobs by metro. And it's very accurate because we cut social security checks in the US based on those numbers. So unemployment numbers in the US are extremely accurate and extremely new, and they are by city or metro. So you can go to departmentofnumbers.com and find your way to basically employment levels for metros. It'll give you every metro in the US. Your goal is to find metros that are above 2% in job growth for the last 12 months, right? What do I go for? I go for metros that are above 3%. So one of the things I like to say in my boot camps, when I'm teaching boot camps to my students, I say 2%, you're satisfied. 3%, you're happy. 4%, it's time to buy champagne. 5% is naked dancing on the street, right? Preferably on weekends, right?
Right.
And I can give you right now the markets that I am in, and unfortunately, I have to move markets every year because of this. They're in naked dancing territory. So Atlanta, Tucson, Arizona, Provo, Utah, Boise, Idaho, Las Vegas, Nevada, Orlando, Florida, are all naked dancing on street markets. And that should really answer the question that anybody has of, should I be investing my money at this point? Of course you should be. Rent increases are at 5%. That's a supply-demand gap. But for every market that's at 4 or 5%, unfortunately, there are dozens, if not hundreds of markets that are 0%. And it's your job, whether you're investing for yourself or for your investors, to make sure you are going into markets that have these significant job increases. I'm sorry, not rents, job increases, right? Because jobs drive everything. Jobs drive everything. By the time you have markets that are at 4 or 5%, and it's very rare to see 5% job growth markets in the US. So typically you'll see three. Three is a very common number. Orlando has been at three for 27 successive months. Provo, Utah tends to stay very close to 3%. So, I mean, when you're in markets that are 3% job growth, everything works, Hunter. You can make lots of mistakes, but everything works. And that's the beauty of it, right? And people are like, well, so did you ever invest in Provo, Utah? No, I tried. I failed. I just went out and bought a piece of land and built a 102 unit. It's been at 100% occupancy for its multifamily since the day it was built. Truly 100%.
That's pretty remarkable. First of all, I want to thank you for providing all that level of detail, especially, you know, that's basically the playbook. I really love having guests on the show that share information with that much detail. You're basically saying, look, here's what has been able to get me the success that I've been able to achieve. Just go do it. If we're going to compete together, I'm confident I'll be able to perform well, but also I'd like to see you succeed. So that's just, I mean, really, really thank you. We'll link to some of that stuff in the show notes page. But even before we go on, I wanted to mention that because there's a lot of knowledge there. That's a system that you spent thousands of hours creating and likely thousands of dollars in terms of resources. At least if you were even just thinking about it alone, it's still a lot of time. So I appreciate that. I want to get on kind of the other side of the thing, right? So let's talk about some of the red flags. When do you start to see something in a marketplace where you start to say, okay, it's time to sell. Okay, it's time for a pullback. What's your thoughts on when you start to see things turning around? You mentioned San Francisco, for example, which experienced, you know, a negative month over month, and it's likely going to have a year over year negative as well. What do you think about that market, for example? Is that something that you would be selling assets in if you owned them? Or is that something that you're anticipating kind of a small gradual decline back to normalcy?
Well, I'm actually predicting a small positive, variance when it comes to home prices in the San Francisco Bay Area, but a small negative variance when it comes to rents. Remember, sometimes home prices and rents can go two different ways.
Yeah.
And the San Francisco Bay Area is extraordinarily supply constrained. It is the most NIMBY market in the US. Nobody wants anybody, not in my backyard is the most common word used here. And so as a result, that market still has room to grow, but it's beyond its heydays, right? So at this point, last year, the San Francisco Bay Area market basically didn't grow, didn't shrink. Now it's going to grow a little bit further, but it's going to grow because of the single largest slew of IPOs in its history. So Zoom and Lyft have already gone public, and Slack, Palantir, Airbnb, and Uber are coming up. These create thousands of millionaires, which creates speculative, you know, booms in the marketplace. So the market will be slightly positive in terms of home price growth, probably 3%, 2 to 3% is what most predictions are. And if it wasn't for those IPOs, it would be at zero. So the Bay Area is a very stable market. It's not a high risk market at this point in time. I don't think there's any risk of a crash at all. But I think it's a market that you're not going to make a lot of money in. And given that it's a three cap market, it's not like you have any cash flow anyway, but now you also don't have appreciation. So what you're really looking for are markets that are continuing to show very strong job growth, because job growth really in the end will lead to all of your profits, right? Maybe not today, maybe not 6 months from now, but in the long run, you need those jobs. And so if there's one statistic you really want to look at beyond that income statistics that I talk about, it's that job growth, because it's going to drive up your numbers over time. And also, you know, high job growth is safety, right? It's much safer to be in markets that have job growth. So one of the things that I don't like seeing is on that Department of Numbers website, which I look at least once a month, I usually look at it several times a month, is I don't like ziggy-zaggy numbers. So for example, if there's a city that I'm investing in, or I'm thinking of investing in it, and job growth numbers for March 2019 are 2%, And then April, 1%. And then March, you know, then in May, they're back to 2%. And then the next month, they fall again to 1%. That city is experiencing problems. That city is basically trying its level best to keep up its job growth rate. And for whatever reason, it isn't doing well. Think of that as turbulence, right, for your plane. There's a lot of turbulence. We don't know if it's going to get worse or not, but it may be time to look elsewhere. Because I can honestly tell you, Hunter, there are so many better places to look at that when you sense turbulence, it just makes sense to walk away. Yeah. Yes, you all of the links you built in that city, unfortunately, are not monetized. But either you are data-driven or you're not. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, I really like that. Well, speaking of data-driven, I want to touch on something that obviously comes up a lot. So there is something that people that are obsessed with data, like you and I, hate to hear, but sometimes come around to accepting, which is the quote, "This time it's different." Now, this time it's different can mean a lot of things, but hear me out. So basically, we saw something in 2008, which anybody that's been in the business knows was a very significant, and I will say, basically an aberration rather than the norm, right? It was ahistoric in the sense of the significance of the correction and the fact that the significant downturn in real estate was also coincided with and potentially caused a massive, basically global financial crisis.
Worldwide crisis, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So with that in mind, what are some of your thoughts on looking at markets where you're basically seeing a market that was trading at 8 caps or even 7 caps, let's say, to be conservative, back in those times, and now it's trading at 5 caps. How do you justify buying a property in a 5 cap in a market that was trading at 7 caps just, let's say, 8 years ago? What are your thoughts on that?
You're not going to like my answer, Hunter. And the answer is, this time it's different. And I'm going to explain to you what my beliefs are specifically. So what we did in 2008 was so radical and so absurd, in my opinion, that it actually changed the world. It changed the way that the financial system works, not just real estate, not just stocks, but everything. What we did was something known as quantitative easing, right? So what we did was we printed, in the US, we did $4.3 trillion. That's $4,300 billion. You basically, it's such an absurd amount of money that it's even hard to comprehend it, right? We printed that much money and we injected it into the system as liquid. Now that money is real. It is running around the United States looking for yield, but its current yield is zero, right? Now, when we did this, other countries thought, oh, look, the US recovered. They recovered faster than anybody else. Let's print our own money. So the European Central Bank did it, the Japanese Central Bank, the Chinese, the Indians, everyone followed. Altogether, the world ended up printing a staggering amount of brand new liquidity, over $10 trillion, 10,000 billion. Okay. Now imagine when you take this money and you inject it into the system, money, when it's created as debt, right? So this is one of the fundamental things you have to learn about finances. When money is created out of thin air, it's created, always created as debt. So it needs yield. That money needs yield, Hunter. The rest of the world, with the exception of the United States, the rest of the developed world, is at zero yield. If today in Switzerland, I want to buy a 10-year treasury bond, I have to pay the Swiss government to lend money to them. Did you hear what I just said? I have to pay the Swiss government to lend money to them for 10 years. In Japan, I have to pay the government. In Germany, I have to pay the government. That makes no sense whatsoever, right? I mean, that is so absurd. The concept that I have to give money to somebody and pay that person so that they can take my money is absurd. And anybody that thinks that the world has come back to normal or comes back to normal needs to explain to me that why is it that today, this morning, if I wanted to buy a Swiss bond, that I would get a sub-zero yield? The answer is that $10 trillion that we injected into the world economy is looking for yield, and that current yield is zero. Which is why real estate in the United States at 6%, and that's our overall yield in the US for real estate, seems extraordinarily lucrative. The answer to your question is that market at 8 cap made sense before 2008. Today, it makes sense at 5, let's say 5.5. I'm not sure if 5 cap is the right number, but let's say it's at 6 cap. It makes all the sense in the world at 6 cap because that $10 trillion out there in bonds is still at zero. And that money continues to flow into the United States. Inward capital flows into the US, both in commercial real estate and single family, are at all-time highs. Why? Because that money needs yield, and they're really, really happy with 5% because they're at zero. Until we put the $10 trillion genie back into the bottle, the laws of real estate and the laws of money will remain perverted. And you might think, well, yeah, now that we've recovered, we're going to do it. Really? You know that only one country in the world has actually made an attempt to reverse quantitative easing? That's us. That's our Federal Reserve. And we withdrew out of the $4.3 trillion that we injected. We roughly withdrew $360 billion, which is about 8%. So in 9 years, we have withdrawn 8%. The rest of the world has withdrawn nothing. So as long as we remain in this extremely unusual world, we have a new understanding of what cap rates mean. When that money is withdrawn, yeah, we're going to go back to 8 cap, right? At some point, there'll be a crash and we'll go back to 8 cap. But who is trying to even withdraw the money? The one country in the world that was doing it for the last 2 years has signaled in January, that's us, that they're going to stop doing quantitative tightening. So when that money stays in the marketplace, 5 to 6 cap is an extraordinarily good return for real estate.
Yeah, man, it's fascinating. And it's so interesting because that $4.3 trillion is so significant and it's almost never talked about, let alone the cumulative $10 trillion that you mentioned earlier. The global financial markets are incredibly connected, and that demand for yield, there are only a couple options out there. Bonds are the massive, 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 massive piece of the market. And when those market signals are saying you're going to necessarily lose money when you invest in these vehicles, people, money managers, people that control hundreds and millions and billions of dollars are looking otherwise. And when you look at the entirety of what's available out there and you think of cash as an investment, and you think of bonds as an investment, you think of real estate as an investment because they're all investments. Where are you going to put your money? Real estate, particularly U.S. real estate, becomes incredibly desirable. And that is actually something that, you know, most real estate investors probably 20 years ago were not having this conversation because the implications weren't as significant. But now we've opened that Pandora's box, and now this is part of the conversation indefinitely. I mean, I'll let you know when this is an important part of the conversation, but it's not now. So
I mean, and I think most people don't realize this, that since 2008, we are not real estate investors. You're not a real estate investor. I'm not a real estate investor. We are now basically part of the worldwide liquid securities market. Okay. And other people sitting somewhere in Japan or Thailand are affecting my cap rates, which did not happen until 2008. Because the world basically, you know, believe it or not, pension funds in these countries that have zero bond yields are changing their laws with the sole intent of changing their laws so they can hold less bonds, so they can hold more stocks and real estate. That's what I keep hearing. Stocks and real estate is what they want. And the number one destination in the US that they in the world that they intend to invest this money in is the US, because we happen to be the only major country in the world that is offering yield on our 10-year treasury bonds. This means that we are the only real economy. Our 10-year treasury bonds, as of today, yield 2.4%. That is vastly better than Switzerland, where they yield zero. Germany, close to zero. Japan, zero. So if every other economy in the world has zero yield on 10-year treasury bonds, what does that say about their economies? What it says is that we may be a pig, but we're definitely the best-looking pig in this pigsty.
Absolutely. Man, we could go back and forth, and I know that we have got to be cautious about the time here. So I'll ask just a few more questions and let you kind of mention some of the sources that we're talking about in the bio. Other than the market analysis, other than some of those macroeconomic trends, do you see any other trends that you think investors should be mindful of? And again, I know we have to be a little bit quick here, but what are some of the things that come to mind? If it was kind of like a fire round, what would give your example?
Number one, start reading information about home ownership rates in the United States. There are some excellent PDFs on my website at www.multifamilyu.com/toolkit. read home ownership trends. It'll open your eyes. It'll give you lots of different avenues to invest. Number two, look at trends like co-living. These are disruptive elements, sort of like the way Uber disrupted the taxi industry. Look at co-living and make sure you're tracking those. And then the last thing I want to mention is that everything I gave you was trends on cities that I invest in. Much more important than cities is neighborhoods. So 2 years ago, I designed a course. That course is free. It is on udemy.com, udemy.com/realfocus, one word, real focus. Go in there and I'll give you five more metrics for neighborhoods and you'll become an instant expert in neighborhoods throughout the United States. Those trends are even more powerful than cities.
Wow, that is an awesome fire round. Okay, well, there is a ton of information on there. Go ahead and mention the www.multifamilyu. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes page. Other than that, let the listeners know how they can learn more about you and your firm.
The best way is really through our education arm. Multifamilyu.com is not a multifamily portal. It's a real estate portal. About 40 of our 100 webinars a year are about multifamily, core multifamily, everything from how to get multifamily loans to doing multifamily due diligence to doing underwriting. Basically, every facet of multifamily is covered in 40 webinars. And then there's 60 webinars a year that are agnostic, right? So if you love single family, you'll love those 60. If you love fix and flip, you'll still love them. The information about trends, about hot cities for fix and flip, hot cities for and whole single family investing. It is meant to be an education portal. We are extraordinarily, crazily, anally strict about the quality of content that's on there. So if anybody comes in with a pitch and we look at their deck and they're not providing real and immediate value, they are never going to present on our platform. But you will see dozens and dozens of amazing investors presenting on our platform throughout the year. So check out multifamilyu.com. My email address, I'm available to anybody, is neil@multifamilyu.com. That's N-E-A-L. I use the Irish spelling, not the American spelling. neal@multifamilyu.com.
Awesome. Well, Neil, thanks again. We have to have you on in a few months to talk about other topics because I know this is something you're constantly working on. But I can't thank you enough. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Hunter. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, listeners, thanks for checking out the episode. As always, the contact information for our guest will be available in the show notes page, which is hosted on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher. Don't forget, if you want access to some of the free goodies that I'm talking about at the beginning of these episodes, like free ebooks, weekly investor emails, and articles about some of the most important investment-related topics, make sure that you have created an account with CFC because this stuff is automatically available. You can do this by going to cashflowconnections.com and signing up as an accredited investor. Of course, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com. Thanks again.